PM, so I think I'll just start if there is no one says otherwise. So, my talk is called Parade of the Omega Point, and the topic is the resonance between religious ideas and techno-futurism. Techno-futurism, in the context of this talk, I'll simply define as having ideas about the future as a product of technological development. Technological development that may influence society, the human being, our psychology, or whatever. And this kind of idea is, for example, present in science fiction literature very often, where we have much talk about how some sort of technological development may influence society. And recent examples, for example, include the idea that with modern technology, we may be able to put a man on the moon, for example, or even further, on planet Mars, or maybe settle other planets and explore the universe and colonize the galaxy, etc. And that is, for example, a very recent techno-futurist idea that had some resonance in the past. But in the more recent decades, colonizing space has somewhat vanished from our priority list. And other techno-futurist ideas have taken the place, such as, for example, stuff that has to do with information technology or the internet. So the internet, more recently, is something that we project a lot of ideas on how our future could look like and how this sort of technology might change society to something better or worse. Many ideas, of course, have to deal with the present reality of the internet and what it does for our society, but there are also people who like to speculate how information technology and how the interconnection of our different computer brains might actually change society in the future, or a certain direction that they might change it to. And so, for example, here's a quote from, or rather some fragments from a famous article by Kevin Kelly in Wired in 2005, that talks about the internet, or rather the web, in terms of something that occurred in the past, presented as seen from the future, and that deeply changed the course of human history. And he talks about the web as something that created a sort of big global brain. That is, we all put our brains, our machines together to create one super machine, and this super machine made it possible for some sort of global consciousness to evolve. And this sort of global consciousness appeared in the year 2005 or other years surrounding it, but it was just the beginning. So, of course, he expects that there will be further development in that direction and that this will profoundly change civilization and human culture. And we may also know these kinds of ideas about how internet technology may change the human race or the image of civilization from, for example, a lot of people proposing their new web services as somewhat revolutionary. So if you've been to some Web 2.0 conferences, you've seen many talks where people talk about how extremely disruptive their own technology will be to society, to the market, etc. So this is some kind of techno-futurist sphere of ideas. And there are other ideas that are currently floating around. For example, the idea that we can change our human body and its restrictions by technology, for example, artificial limbs, or maybe changing our genome, or maybe putting some kinds of machines onto our eyes or our brain that may change the way that we perceive the world and may extend our abilities to think or to see. And that's what many transhumanists really like, to transcend the human form, to build up something that has roots in the biological human form as it was created by evolution, but is actually extended by technology. But I think from all the currently the ideas that are currently popular in the terms of techno-futurism, I think what needs a lot of focus is the idea of the technological singularity. It's a sort of catch-all techno-futurist idea, because all other ideas of techno-futurism usually end up also being put into visions of how this sort of future will look like. And the technological singularity basically is the idea that future growth of computational capacities will lead us up to a point where machine intelligence far surpasses biological intelligence, and that this will greatly disrupt civilization, that it will basically turn the world upside down. Singularitarians believe that Moore's law will extend far into the future, at least long enough that the computational capabilities that are available to us will grow enormous, will grow gigantic to a degree that further fuels our machines for thinking, for science, for discovery. That is, our progress in these areas will be powered by Moore's law, and so our progress in areas of what can we do with the world, what are we able to technologically, and what do we understand about the cosmos and how to manipulate it, will grow as well, exponentially. And if we project these ideas into the future and we end up with this gigantic potential quite soon, that is somewhere in the next decades. So singularitarians argue that we live in a time of accelerating change, and that is already now we experience a lot of change in a very high frequency, that is disruptive technology, etc., appearing. Not just every 10 years or so, but it feels more like they appear every year or every month now, and that this is an acceleration from how fast development was previously in the past, and that in the next decades this development will grow even faster, so that when we look in the future, maybe 40 years from now, what will now to us seem like a quick development, that is, the number of the frequency of disruptions that we experience through technology nowadays will then seem rather slow, because then such a number of disruptions may occur in a week or in an hour or during a second. And that at that point in the future, of course, we will all be extended our own brains to experience time in a different way, so it may to us not feel that fast. We may just experience it as normal, but seen from now, this concentration of ever more accelerating development in the future may seem rather like a point in the future and not some period of time, because everything will happen almost at once if we see it from the passing of time as we experience it nowadays. And what will happen then is, of course, that the capacities for technological change will grow massively, and that will make many things possible that may be unimaginable to us nowadays. So singularitarians believe that basically everything that now seems impossible to us may then become possible, because we, of course, will have available extremely more power, extremely more intelligence to calculate solutions to problems that we now consider impossible to solve, and that we will make many, many new discoveries in a short amount of time. And so this singularity time is a sort of place where we can project all kinds of futurist ideas towards, which we now consider may take hundreds of years to evolve. So for example, singularitarians like to project stuff like mind uploads onto that future time, or the ability for machines to exterminate the human race because they become much more powerful than us, the Skynet scenario, or us humans becoming one with the machines and their growing intelligence, and thereby becoming somewhat like gods, being able to understand everything and being able to manipulate our environment in ways that we could not believe possible now. You have any wish list that you have from your dreams can be projected into this future development of the singularity, of this point in the future where the world as we know it will end, because the basis of the world that is structured by restricted human intelligence changes to something that is structured by superhuman intelligence, and that will think in terms that are not available to us. Now all these ideas of there will come some point in the future that will profoundly change the world and put everything on its head, and that will greatly enable us to do things that are now impossible, and that will throw away all our restrictions, or may destroy humanity, or may actually put an end to our world or the universe. All these ideas have been called somewhat religious by some people. They remind people of biblical stories of the end time, of the apocalypse, etc. And the same can also be said about other techno-futurist ideas like this global brain and global consciousness that evolves in the Kevin Kelly article quoted at the early point in this talk, where we have the idea that things that we now consider inanimate or just merely a configuration of machines now suddenly develops something that we cannot yet understand, some sort of vital energy that to us is not actually visible in dead machines as we build them. And so there is a lot of, let's say, spirituality, a lot of apocalyptic ideas, etc., to be found in techno-futurism, and this reminds some people of religious ideas. And this is maybe somewhat embarrassing because techno-futurists, of course, like to see themselves in the tradition of science, of rationalism, of the Enlightenment. And if you see yourself in such a tradition, very often it happens that you see religion more as something that is middle-aged superstition, and you don't want to be mixed up with that. But at the same time, it is undeniable that there seem to be patterns somewhat similar to certain religious promises. Now, there is actually a long history of ideas on how there might be similarities between narratives of progress, historical progress, and, for example, narratives of Christianity. So if you take the Enlightenment, you have some time in the history where there is where everything is dark and unreasonable and stupid, the Middle Ages, and then suddenly there comes a moment when people understand and there is a lot revealed to them, and now they can finally take their fate into their own hands and work towards progressive improvement of the human race and of society and towards goals like democracy or egalitarianism. And if you really look closely at it, you may find similarities in certain interpretations, for example, of how Christianity shaped the historical, the image, that the way that people saw history. So you have some sort of dark times, and then you have some point of revelation where either God talks to the Jews or Jesus Christ comes to earth, and from that point on, people have a plan to guide them to live better, live in a way that will improve the fate of the humans, that will lead maybe even to some end point where everyone who lived according to that plan for well-being was saved and put into heaven. That is, put into some sort of paradise, a sort of life that is much better than we experience now. And the same is, of course, true for working towards some enlightenment goal of, for example, a society that is structured more rationally and thereby solves many problems, or a society where diseases are cured by science, or a society where humans are changed in a way to behave more ethically, communism, for example. You always have this situation that we have to work towards this future point, and then everything will become better, and we have to work according to some plan, some truth that was revealed to us. But that is a long history of ideas, and it is also somewhat controversial. I don't want to argue that you can simply say that that all narrators of progress and all narrators of Christianity are the same, but just to mention there are some people who have researched into that matter, and to also argue that with Christianity there comes a different point, a way to see progress, to see history. That is, you have many religions who work in a way that history is something static or something cyclic. You do not have a progressive improvement, but rather you have the reappearance of always the same actions. And now you suddenly have a story which has a beginning and an end, and you actually have a moral progression through that story. You have the cosmos or society or some tribe working to become ever better and to follow some plan to reach some positive end point. As I said, is a long story, and you could fill many books on it, but I want to concentrate on something much more recent and something that fits much better into techno-futurist contexts, and that is basically two books by these two guys, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin and Frank J. Tipler, who for different reasons I think fit quite well into considering resonance between techno-futurist and religious ideas. In short, both are religious people, and both fit somehow into the framework of Christianity and their ideas, and both tell stories about how the cosmos evolves from some stage to an ever more higher stage of consciousness towards becoming, via man, ever more spiritual, more intelligent, etc., until some sort of end point is reached. And let's start right away with Tayari Fardan. He lived from 1881 till 1955. He was a Jesuit priest, and he was a paleontologist and geologist, and he was very interested in theories of evolution. And he tried to actually put both together, his Christian beliefs and his understanding of evolution. He could not deny that there seems to be some change in the history of the world and of life, and he tried to put that into a meaningful connection to his own Christian beliefs. And he wrote books on that topic, and these books got banned by the Catholic Church, and at the same time he was also not so beloved by scientists, because to them his visions also seemed somewhat too religious. So he did not really succeed maybe in a synthesis that that got accepted as science or as religious truth. But over time, the decades after his death, he found some resonance with people who one would not assume would be so directly interested in him. That is, he ended up as someone who provided references and quotes and phrases to new media theorists. So for example, he was quoted by Marshall McLuhan. Later he was quoted by the Wired magazine, because what he described in his book, that is this main book of his that I will focus on, is basically something that could easily be taken as a metaphor for globalization, for ever tighter connected communication, electronic communication media, or the internet and the World Wide Web. Now, about this book. This book is basically structured in telling the story of the universe. It starts with the formation of matter, goes on to the formation of stars and planets, and then finally it focuses on planet Earth, and then it goes through different geological stages of Earth and describes how different spheres evolved, the lithosphere, etc., up until the biosphere. So he talks a lot about how the chemical composition of the planet structures itself anew through many stages until it reaches some structuring that biologists might call life. And to him then enters a further stage, that man appears, and man again restructures the composition of Earth around him. And then it's the biosphere gets sort of, there's over the biosphere a new sphere appears, and that is what he calls the noosphere, the sphere of mind, of thought. And this is basically the result of human beings, via their intelligence, being able to reorganize their environment and to fill it with their artifacts, fill it with their intelligence, fill it with lines of communication. It's a growing web of humans moving over the planet, communicating with each other, exchanging information via letters, later, of course, electronic communication, via telephone lines, etc. And this, to him, is a new composition of the surface of the Earth, because if we look back at this, we have sort of composition which first grows further and further towards life, and then, according to Tayar, further and further towards intelligence. but the interesting thing is, of course, that we can easily imagine considering the Earth's surface filled with man and his artifacts, and that in itself may not be so impressive, but to Tayar, he really likes the holistic picture. It's not just individuals communicating with each other, it's actually this whole communication and this number of individuals forming some kind of new organism. And this is, of course, where something like the Kevin Kelly metaphors previously of global consciousness forming fit very well into this. And so another metaphor for the noosphere was actually well described by Wired itself in an article praising Tayar for his ability to prefigure the World Wide Web, that is, the globe globing itself with a brain. And now Tayar really likes to think in stages, and to him this is just another stage of the biosphere and the noosphere. And if we are now currently living in the age where the noosphere evolves, the product of man and his intelligence and his interconnectedness, then that may not necessarily be the last stage. That is, to Tayar, man currently is the peak of evolution, but it will go on. And he thinks, how could this evolve further? So he imagines that he looks at this the table, and to him he sees a progression of ever higher forms of life and intelligence, and of course then that must go on, that is the future life, even higher developed forms of life and intelligence. And if he projects that into the future, he ends up at some point of highest intelligence and vitality and transcendence, finally, of the physical world, and that is what he calls the point omega. And the point omega, it's a bit, he does not really describe it in detail, in contrast to what we will see later with Tipler, but to him the point omega is the necessary end result of a development that he sees as happening progressively in the entire universe. And this development, to him, seems the way that the universe, to his eyes, evolves only makes sense if one thinks at the end such an omega point, and if one interprets into the universe and its development some kind of directedness. Now he's very careful not to use terms that would imply a designer of the universe or of life or of life forms. He does not say that man looks like he looks because he is God imaged, and that evolution was forced to develop in a certain direction so that man could have 10 fingers or something like that. But he argues that he can see in the whole process, from how matter forms, how planets forms, how life forms, how man formed, common rules of evolution, certain patterns that appear again and again, of how some primitive forms configure themselves to reach other stages of complexity, and that these rules apply to each such stage, and that therefore it is very intuitive to assume that these rules will continue to happen. And he argues that one applies such patterns not just on biological evolution, but that one must apply them on the formation of physical laws, on the formation of planets, of rocks, that one must equally apply them on how cultures evolve, on how ideas evolve. So someone familiar with the term of the meme from Richard Dawkins might find ways to connect his ideas to these. But the main thing is that he sees that this whole, it's not just that we have these patterns reappearing, it is that actually we have stages where the universe always creates one stage, and then in this stage these rules reappear, but they appear on a higher order of complexity. So that the universe really evolves from one stage to the next, to the next, to the next, somewhat linearly towards some point. It's not just that you have different, that you have a tree with different branches that go into many different directions, and then you have planet Earth here with some sort of development, and then you have another planet here with a different sort of development. Instead, to Tayar, it's very important that everything seems to lead to a point of ever higher concentration that needs to capture all the surrounding resources for it to reach this next higher stage of complexity. So to Tipler, it makes kind of sense that the universe created planet Earth, but once planet Earth is created, everything important actually happens on planet Earth. That is, to Tipler, there are unfortunately no aliens, because in his theory, one could say cosmic evolution, each stage is configured from, one could say, some sort of chaos, an experiment, a chance that happens, but at one point some sort of complexity and some sort of order evolves that necessarily eradicates everything else and pulls all resources together to concentrate on one single point, and then everything important happens at that point. And that, to him, is Earth, and then on Earth the same happens again until there's only one kind of life that evolves, and then there's only one kind of intelligent conscious life that evolves, etc. So necessarily there's always some concentration upon one point. And that explains why in his vision there is not much space for things happening in parallel. This fits very well into his idea of directedness of the universe, for why should the universe waste resources somewhere else when already the next stage has been reached. That is, we are already on the stage of higher consciousness. On stages of lower consciousness, nothing important will happen. And another important aspect of Tayar's theory is that to him there are two kinds of energies, and it is this duplicity of energies that explains explains how the cosmic evolution takes place towards ever higher forms of consciousness. Because on the one hand, there is the tangential energy, and that is basically the laws of physics as we would learn them from hard science. And on the other hand, there's radial energy. The tangential energy is you have everything happens according to the laws of physics, to Newton's physics or quantum physics or any kind of physics that you like, but you do not have in these physics something that explains why things organize themselves towards higher forms that get closer to some point of, let's say, intelligence or consciousness. To Teilhard, this development towards higher forms of vitality or consciousness can only be explained by some kind of other energy also working from things, and that is the radial energy. He also used terms like to imply that tangential energy is sort of the outside of things and radial energy is sort of the inside of things. So there is some sort of dualism in his theory, and this dualism actually gets applied to explain the development of the physical world. That is, you have things, for example, some molecules or some stupid animals, and if you would just leave them to themselves to act by the laws by the traditional laws of nature, by the laws of tangential energy, then they would not produce some higher stage. They would act stupidly. But you have some sort of pull that that leads them to reorganize them to some higher, complexer form, and that form then leads to the next stage that gets closer to the omega point. And yeah, that's basically his idea of how we get this sort of directedness in the universe and its development, and how we get to higher forms of consciousness. And to him, actually, consciousness and life, vitality, is not something that evolves at some point, but is present throughout the whole course of evolution. That is, to him, there is some sort of vitality and intelligence even in a rock. That is actually what made the church dislike his theories, not so much that he tried to fit the theory of evolution into them. And so to him, the whole life has some sort of vitality and spirit in it, even though we find it where we would have very big difficulty in finding it in a piece of dead rock. But as a piece of dead rock is part of this greater plan of vitalism, somehow it still moves towards this. Somehow there is still some vitality in it. And to Teilhard, of course, technology also plays some role, because technology is just some agent of the noosphere to reach the next highest stage of development. That is, humans, once they appear on the surface of planet Earth, may have reason, may have intelligence, but by themselves they are still somewhat helpless. But they learn to reorganize their environment into tools to communicate ever deeply, to reorganize themselves, to move themselves, for example, into cities, or to communicate electronically, or to circle the planet via airplanes. And that, to him, is how technology is part of this whole plan to create the noosphere and to greaten its conscious energy, to make this brain work faster, to make this brain more integrated. And now to there, from this point on, one would, it would maybe sound like a nice new age religion, what that one could make of it, but there's still not much need for Christianity in it. But now Teilhard tries to put, at this point, tries to put in some relevance for Christianity or for religious faith, because Teilhard argues in this cosmic evolution, man is the first intelligence and consciousness that can actually understand this plan of nature, can look back at it, can see the rules of how this development occurs, can see how we evolve ever higher through stages, and can actually assume that there may be a next stage to develop to. And at the same time, man, via his reason, via his intelligence, that will enable him to, or that should enable him, to push development even further via technology, at the same time feels that he has the power and actually the responsibility to guide this development, because now man is the agent of change, man is the agent of the cosmic evolution. And at the same time, understanding that one has this power may become very dangerous, because now man may crush under his responsibility. He may doubt that he has the power to actually fulfill this plan. He may become doubtful that it is something that he wants. He may say, I'm quite satisfied with living as a human being, with living in a time where, okay, I can grow 100 years old and I can have children and that's all nice. Why should I try to create something that replaces me with a next higher conform consciousness? Or he may freak out when he sees that his intelligence and his reason enables him to build machines that can destroy the planet, and then he may become very afraid that it isn't his intelligence that will actually stop this development, may actually stop the cosmic evolution. So man may come at a point where he may decide not to pursue the path further. He may come to this point by way of doubt and by way of overanalyzing things and by way of trusting too much in this analysis and not enough in the pattern of cosmic evolution that is imprinted into him. And at this point, it may actually become helpful if man develops a sort of trust in the meaningfulness of this cosmic development and also in the ability of the cosmos to guide him to further push this development towards the Omega point. And at this point, faith is necessary. That is, trust in the cosmos and its ability to push us further. And he also argues that there are, of course, different religions that may also preach different kinds of faith, and these religions may actually also be considered as somewhat these tools that help us in our goal to develop some sort of higher consciousness, some sort of, for example, higher sympathy and interconnectedness with people, but that among these religions, Christianity is especially worthwhile, because Christianity teaches values that, in contrast to other religions, seem to be especially well formed to fit this plan towards the Omega point. So he argues that basically, as a Christian, you are well equipped to evolve further to a higher form of consciousness. And now there are some interesting things about Tayang's idea. First, of course, that he did influence with these images techno-futurists of the internet age so much, because maybe there is some sort of sympathy towards ideas that we evolve some sort of higher higher consciousness. And of course, among internet enthusiasts, there is often some kind of enthusiasm for things that organize themselves to some sort of quality that we would not have if they would be left alone. And of course, that distracted by him entering the room. But there is also, I think, some things that we can criticize at his ideas, and that may explain what may be problematic about these resonance between techno-futurist ideas and religious ideas. So, for example, it is this whole idea of this idea of faith, and it's somewhat interesting that, at the one hand, Tayar argues that this development is inevitable. Cosmos is set up in a way that will lead towards the Omega point. And at the same time, he argues that we need some sort of faith to actually make that happen, that we must not doubt it too much, because if we would do so, then maybe it would not happen, and that's not according to plan. And this reminds me a bit of some discourses where, on the one hand, techno-futurists like to argue that the development they promote is inevitable and that we have to accept it, and on the other hand, feel somewhat frightened by people who argue against it and who threaten to stop it. That on the one hand, we tell people, you have no ways to stop it, and on the other hand, we tell people, oh, we have to stop these reactionaries from making this path too hurtful or actually stop it. And the other thing is his whole model of how the world, of how this development occurs, that is, it's somewhat without alternative. There is one path towards the Omega point, towards the final revelation, etc. And this path occurs in stages that that make it impossible for parallel stuff to happen and for parallel potentials. That is, that each stage in itself sort of kills the potential for other things to develop at its borders. Instead, at once some sort of complexity has arrived, it kills all competitors, and now only from this stage something new can evolve, and it will then only be this line of development that really matters, and other lines die out and become irrelevant. One final thing about Tayar that is very interesting is that, as I said, to him everything concentrates on one point. To reach the Omega point at the end, everything needs, for example, to concentrate on planet Earth, because planet Earth, encapsulated in itself, forces life on it to always be thrown on itself and to develop new ways to deal with itself. So some sort of self-reflection happens because we are restricted to one point, to planet Earth. And this to him also makes it possible that man could find some path to the future by extending into the universe, by going out and colonizing space. That to him is totally uninteresting. To him there is only one point in the end where everything leads to, and we must not get distracted by looking to the left or to the right. Now to the other guy that I wanted to talk about, Frank Jennings Tipler, born 1947, mathematical physicist and cosmologist. And he's most famous for expounding his own omega point theory in papers and books of that in their titles increasingly betray his religious leanings. And I want to concentrate on this, which is maybe his most famous book. And in it, he also, like Teilhard, argues that there is some sort of directedness in the universe towards some evolving form of consciousness. In contrast to Teilhard, he does not work so much with ideas of evolution. His topics that he likes are quantum physics and information theory. His idea of how the cosmos will evolve in the next, he focuses much more on how the cosmos will evolve in the future, and not like Teilhard, who basically sees patterns in the past and does very little to imagine how they could turn out in the future. Tipler argues that in the next millions and billions of years we will be driven to extend our intelligence and our machinery ever further into the cosmos, that we will build machines that will colonize space with our intelligence and try to reorganize space ever more towards more intelligence machinery that reproduces our own mind. And he argues that this, in the turn of millions and billions of years, will actually incorporate the whole universe. So that in the end, the whole universe basically becomes one great internet, or one great cosmic brain, or one great cosmic computer. And once this stage is reached, we encounter the problem that, unfortunately, the universe at some point will die. And that is somewhat unfortunate, because we finally have evolved into the sort of super brain, and now it needs to deal with death. And he argues that we do not fear that, we do not need to fear that, because when the universe threatens to die in the future, then this supercosmic computer will find ways to guide that dying, and to actually harvest it for energy. And he argues that as the universe collapses, some sort of energy will become available to this computer and will grow towards infinity, so that as the universe comes closer to its end, this computer will have ever more computing capability. It will work ever faster, and it will ever more space and energy inside itself to work with, and ever more time inside itself to work with. So that in the last microsecond of the universe, this computer inside itself will have an infinity of time still to work through via having super speedy computing cycles. So inside this computer, as the universe collapses, suddenly infinity is reached, life becomes immortal. And now the cool thing about this computer is that in some ways it is and the supercomputer at the end of the universe, of course, I call the omega point, and that in some ways it is like God. That is, it is omnipotent. It controls everything in the universe. It is omniscient. It knows everything because it incorporates the whole universe, and also because it can simulate every universe that there is or ever could have been. And it is omnipresent, of course, because there is no universe outside of it. And the best thing is, it resurrects the dead, because what does such a super cosmic brain do with its spare time? It tries to learn everything. And how do you learn everything? You simply simulate every universe and every intelligence that there ever is, and try to put them into every imaginable configuration. So basically, this supercomputer will be motivated to resurrect every intelligence that there ever was, but also every intelligence that there never was. Now, this beautiful rhythm of the future would still be only accidentally religious if Tipler would not argue that it is not just some project that we could try to entertain for the future. That is, we could have the option to actually realize this plan of colonizing the universe with our intelligence and then turning it into a cosmic computer and then control the collapse of the universe. No, he instead argues that it is not just an option, but it is necessarily so, that it is impossible for anything else to occur. He follows some sort of entropic principle, first by arguing that necessarily the universe is structured in a way that supports life. That in itself may sound not very impressive, but then he argues via some arguments that I myself could not quite grasp, that the universe must necessarily continue to support life into infinity. This has something a bit to do with this omega point at the end of the universe simulating and thereby knowing every universe, and through that creating a state where he as an observer, via some quantum mechanics magic, actually decides what universe existed and what not, and that thereby the only universe that actually could have existed is the one universe that leads to the omega point. And yeah, so in the end, the omega point is true, it must happen, therefore God will necessarily be born and exist in the future. And yeah, that is always, all the stuff, the way he argues is somewhat problematic in his book. He likes to use a lot of highly speculative assumptions and sell them as hard science. I myself would not dare to evaluate scientific arguments in detail, but others have done so, and they argue that what he basically did is do a lot of cosmologic speculation that is very far-fetched, and then present the results of that speculation as something that is agreed upon by the entire scientific community as very certainly true, and then work on from that towards more speculation. And of course, some of the stuff that he assumes is now disproven 20 years or 20 years after the appearance of the book. And the funny thing is also that even though in parts of the book he argues that he's not a Christian, that he comes to all these conclusions only by hard science, that as the book goes on, he more and more tries to prove parts of Catholic doctrine as necessarily true by as his physical theory fits into it. And if you consider the name of his book that he wrote 10 years later, The Physics of Christianity, he seems to have more and more developed into a Christian apologetic. And what is interesting about the way that he argues is that he tries to he argues that theology is not taken seriously enough as a science, that is, theology weakened somewhat by people arguing that you could personally interpret things and not take the Bible literally, etc., and that by this theology more and more drifted away from having things that where you could argue logically from things that people need necessarily agree from. He is more for some sort of dogmatic theology where things are either true or false and not a matter of personal conviction. Having said that, this whole book is still a very good and entertaining read. Some major parts of it work very well as science fiction literature. He describes in great detail how he imagines, for example, the colonization of the universe with von Neumann probes and that replicates themselves, or how in detail life inside the Omega Point, the supercomputer and his simulation of everything would work. For example, he argues that among the people that are resurrected, there would of course also be bad, evil people, for example Hitler, and he argues that these people would, the Omega Point would not dare to put these people into one universe with others as long as they are not morally redeemed and re-educated in a way that they would not behave antisocial towards these other simulated intelligences. Therefore, such evil people would need to be put into different re-education universes where they would, through a long time of pain and learning, redeem themselves. So, and he argues that this is, of course, like Christian purgatory. And then he goes on to argue that there may be some people that are so evil that they cannot even be redeemed by these purgatory simulations. So to these people, it would be like hell. So he basically he tries to bend his theory more and more to fit into some sort of Christian theology that he takes quite literally and tries to prove. Now, this is maybe a good example for coming from some sort of speculation about what is physically or scientifically possible to some idea that you really, really like, and then getting more and more focused on this one idea, and then as something else comes along, just trying to bend it to fit that very idea, so that in the end you have some sort of theology and you try to bend the laws of physics and everything else just to fit this one small idea. And this leads me to the end of the talk and some ideas that I could have that I think one could learn from this, that is these religious nature of some techno-futurist idea fits very well into, for example, having models where everything seems to develop according to one single true plan, and everything needs to fit this one development, and you cannot imagine that things could happen because of some different plan or some different phenomenon. Everything must be summed under this one path towards, for example, the singularity or the omega point. And that you also fall prey to arguing on the one hand that something is inevitable, and then on the other hand arguing that you must believe and have faith in it, for else something bad would happen. People who are smart may not argue that it then may not happen, but they may argue that there will be a catastrophe if you do not believe in the inevitability of this change. And that comes very close to a situation where you have some religious idea that you need to defend on moral grounds, and argue that if you do not believe in it, it's not just some exercise of skepticism, but it is something actually very dangerous not to believe in it. So people who do not believe in it do a moral wrong, and therefore need to be fought from believing it. And then finally, of course, this tendency to fall in love with some vision and then trying to build everything around, to rebuild everything around so that it fits this one vision, and not being open to the possibility that it may be only an option, or that it may actually be wrong. And this is just, I think, one very early start of looking at resonances between religious ideas and techno-futurism. I think one could do much, much more on that topic, but I needed to start somewhere, and I think in these two books I had something nice to show you. Thank you. So I think there is roughly a few minutes until the next talk. I don't know if there is time for questions. I'm looking at the guy who I think is responsible for the room, but he does not react. So if there is any question, do we have still time for questions? Okay, then there are some questions. Ask them.
Okay, I tried the English and without the microphone.
I try to repeat it then.
Okay. I have to admit, I'm a sociologist, and sociologists talks about a lot about if people behave rational or not, or is there something else? And my question would be, do you think it's necessary that people behave rational to get to this omega point? Or do you think that people behave rational?
Well, I myself am quite certain about whether I believe in the omega point. But to argue, for example, as Tayyadi Fadang would do, actually argued that rationality is a good tool to further the progress towards the omega point, but it's also somewhat dangerous. If you become too rational, then you become too doubtful, and then you may actually doubt that the omega point may occur. So, and I think for Tipler, he does not care to him. it's just scientific truth that the omega point will occur, and there's nothing to do against it.
I have a question about the metaphysical claims that Tipler makes in this book. You said that he envisions like the universe will encompass, and well, the computer will encompass the entire universe in the final stages of the universe. That sort of reminded me about theory that takes this as granted, that the universe is already a computer, a big computer, like it works like a cellular automaton. Does he make any commitment to that, to this kind of view that basically the universe is a finite state automaton, like a big one, but it still is? So,
well, to be honest, in his book, he really likes to talk about many, many, many different topics and cite discourses, so I'm quite sure that somewhere he mentions a theory that the universe is cellular automaton. But I think in his theory, the more important point is that the universe is somewhat civilized into becoming even more intelligent at these points. So there's a higher capability of information processing in different parts of the universe than there was before. And this supercomputer is, of course, only a metaphor. even if the universe is some sort of computer or some sort of cellular automaton, it still is not a sort of conscious brain. But in the end, it will be some sort of a brain of very high consciousness, because all these different parts of the computer meet and organize and reconfigure themselves in new ways that enable even more intelligence.
Sorry, I'm just waving at somebody.
Okay.
I have no question.
So is there someone with yet another question?
Yeah. Okay. You can elaborate, we were talking about this universe, this parallel universe where all the bad people would gather, be concentrated. Can you please elaborate what he understands as bad people or people that cannot be healed from their badness?
Well,
is it sick people?
If it's about moral terms, he becomes somewhat problematic. Major parts of his book are problematic, but there he somehow argues that the omega point, even though the omega point really wants to re-simulate everything or to simulate every possible configuration, at the same point, the omega point has some sort of sympathy or love for intelligent beings, that he does not want to put them into situations where they suffer. And then he has a situation where he does not want to put people who make other people suffer into the same universe until he has re-educated them in a way that they do not make other people suffer.
But who cannot be? Didn't you say that some people cannot be re-educated?
He says if there are people that could not be re-educated, then they would actually experience hell, because to them this purgatory universe would be eternal. He does not say whether he is sure that there are people that could be that evil.
Okay, so he doesn't explain what kind of people cannot be re-educated and for what reason.
Well, he basically explains the whole thing, and if there are people who are like that, then they would end up in that. And even though he likes to talk about large parts of his theory as if they are totally sure truth, there are these parts where he says, oh, well, maybe it's like that, maybe it is like that.
Okay. Because if you think it to the end, then it's either he says that they're generally bad people, or it's people that are, for example, born with some kind of damage, which could be an illness, for example, and those would be the bad people.
No, to him, the bad people are just the people who are so antisocial or so hurtful to others, and they cannot be re-educated, that they will have to be left in these re-education universes without ever being put in contact with the people who would suffer from them.
Stupid question, but if there are people that cannot be re-educated by this godlike computer, then the godlike computer is not very godlike, because obviously it's not omnipotent.
Yeah, that would be a valid theological argument against Tipler. I have no answer to that. To me, it makes sense that some sort of his theological arguments do not hold if one scrutinizes them too much.
Thanks, and then I understood it correctly.
Yeah. So, if there is no more question, oh, there is one question.
Yeah,
the far end.
Yeah, I'm actually not quite sure about it, but I think what you were describing is actually not a theology, but a theophany. So it's rather the explanation of the very, you know, of the making of the God, and not of the making of the universe, because Tipler, what was the name?
Tipler.
Yeah. Pretty much described only how this godlike machine is made. I mean, we would be in a theophany, in a point in the process of making a god in this stage.
That is part of his argument, but then of course he also makes detailed claims about how this omega point, once it has appeared, would behave, and what are its attributes, and how these attributes relate to each other. And he even talks about stuff like, how could something like Jesus Christ have actually happened, and maybe there is some time loop from the omega point back into the past, or maybe we already live in a simulated universe where the Christian miracles needed to happen for us, or something like that. So he does not just talk about the creation of God, he tries to fit all assorted elements of theology that he can find somehow into some parts of his book and always try to put them into relation with his omega point theory. So, if there is no other question, then I think I can leave the stage and make room for the next talk.